From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past March when Congress was trying to figure out how to help millions of Americans who were suddenly out of work. The pandemic hit this country quickly, probably more quickly than it should have. And I say quickly, I mean suddenly, without warning, given the fact that the United States did have the luxury of time compared to so many other countries. We watched the coronavirus shut down much of China, then Italy was hammered. Privately, in February, President Trump and his administration were telling donors that the pandemic had the potential to be worse than many people assumed. Publicly, they downplayed the crisis. When it hit in March, the American Prospect's David Dayen writes that Democrats had a window to make demands to ensure help for the people who would be most significantly affected. So he's asking the question now, how did the Democrats fail so badly? Think about who has been most affected by this pandemic and who has remained relatively untouched. First of all, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has floated along, seemingly disconnected from the pain that workers are feeling. Meanwhile, the top 10% of earners in this country have actually increased their share of the economic pie. They're doing well. They're making even more money. The rest of American workers have been devastated. This is a country that has seen the income gap, the wage gap, widen over the recent decades. If you thought the pandemic might even things out, you're wrong. The wealthiest are riding high. David Dayen is my guest this hour. He will break down how we got here and what options are still available to help Americans who are out of work or unable to pay bills. Whatever Wall Street tells you, that is a growing list of people, and it's certainly going to get worse over the winter unless things dramatically change. So let's talk about all of the dynamics that led us here, where we are, what happens going forward. David Dayen, author and editor of The American Prospect, welcome to Connections.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I want to start by asking you about some of what you've been writing and frankly talking on podcasts about recently, which is that there seems to be a lot of surprise in the country about the fact that apparently there's not going to be any new relief from the federal government coming at least before the election, if not quite a bit after. You seem to be the least surprised person in the country about that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I guess I am. And I don't feel like I have any special insight or decoder ring or magic eight ball. I just sort of observe reality. And the reality was that in March, the Republicans had a real problem with a collapsing economy, and particularly a collapsing big business sector and capital markets. And they sought very directly to remedy that. And the remedy was a Federal Reserve-led program that reinstilled confidence in those markets and sent the stock market reversing its slide. And that has continued pretty much to this day. So since then, there has been no real incentive for the Republican rank and file to return to the bargaining table for more stimulus. That's really the central problem here. Now, Donald Trump's a bit of a wild card, and he sees stimulus and particularly checks with his name on them as tied to his reelection. But we're now in a moment where, with Trump down in some cases by polls by double digits, Republicans aren't necessarily inclined to go along with everything he says for once. This may be the worst possible time for them to make that decision from an economic standpoint, but that's the decision made. And so Mitch McConnell just doesn't have any incentive to work a deal right now, for a lot of different reasons, which we can get into.
Well, there's a lot of different prongs here. I want to stick with March, and then we'll kind of move throughout the pandemic here. But in March, what you essentially are indicating is that the Republicans serve a particular set of interests. The Democrats claim to serve a particular set of interests, though, again, I want to get into that, too. But in March, you seem to think, look, the Republicans got what they wanted and needed. They had no incentive to keep negotiating. I mean, who do you see the Republicans as serving?
Yeah, I mean, they're serving capital. They're serving large interests that are in the capital markets that have been able to get corporate bonds, they get lending, have their assets essentially inflated throughout the duration of the crisis, such that if you look at the top 10% of income earners, their unemployment rate is virtually unchanged since the beginning of the pandemic. If you look at billionaires, their wealth has increased by 27% since the beginning of the pandemic. So Republicans, I feel, probably believe they've done their job. They have served their constituents pretty well. Democrats got a little bit of what they wanted for who they purport to be their constituents in the exchange in March in the CARES Act, but it was all temporary. It has all expired, in some cases as far back as last July, or this, you know, most recent July, 3 months ago. And, you know, they're now asking for a second bite of the apple when that second bite of the apple was, I feel, never going to come. They should have treated the first bill like it was going to be the last bill and created some manner of continuing relief until the duration of the national emergency. But because they didn't do that, they're in a tough bargaining position right now, even with the president nominally on their side.
Could Democrats argue that, look, that's not entirely fair because the CARES Act was, what, roughly $3 trillion, and then there was a re-upping of funds for PPP and SBA loans when that money dried up very quickly. And yes, there was a lot of sort of lampooning of that initial round in which I think Shake Shack got a loan. I think the Los Angeles Lakers got money. There was an ambassador who has you know, certainly close ties to the president, whose family business makes a lot of money and it doesn't really look like a small business. They got money. There was a lot of lampooning in that initial round, but there was an infusion of more money for SBA and PPP. Could the Democrats say, look, based on that, we figured we would keep coming back to this well if we needed it?
Well, I mean, let's separate that out. First of all, the second round of PPP was unsuccessful. Over half of that second round has not been used. It expired. And in fact, in the last month of that being active, the loan outlay was actually negative because more firms were giving money back than were actually receiving loans from the PPP. As time went on, it became not useful, number one, because businesses just didn't have that amount of time to wait until they could get a PPP loan. Second of all, because areas with high rents, it was not just, it was a poor business decision, or would have been, to take a PPP loan, which didn't allow for much in the way of offsetting overhead costs. So PPP was just kind of a flawed program in and of itself. The idea that re-upping the second round of PPP without doing anything on the significant priorities that Democrats had, I would say, argues more for my position that the leverage was squandered. At the time, in April, when that second round of PPP was being re-upped, I remember Jake Tapper of CNN asking Nancy Pelosi, don't you think you made a tactical mistake here, particularly around state and local governments who've gotten pretty much no relief from the federal government that they can use to offset revenue shortfalls? Shouldn't you have included that in exchange for something Republicans wanted, which was a second round of PPP? And her answer in April was, just calm down. We will have state and local government relief, and we will have it in a significant way. That was 6 months ago, and we still haven't had that relief. So it's just very clear to me that there was a huge tactical error on the part of Democrats to not get this done. And now we're in a position where the window has cracked open a little bit because Donald Trump, for the purposes of his reelection, wants another deal. But that has not extended by the circumstances of the election to Senate Republicans who hold the cards here. I mean, the idea that there are negotiations going on right now between Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin when Mitch McConnell is not involved in them is about as useful as you and I having negotiations about the stimulus package when the person who will be the decider on it is not involved.
Talking to David Dayen, the executive editor of The American Prospect, the author of Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, and Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, one of the most important books written in a generation, I think, and probably should be required reading for all of us, but especially young adults who are trying to understand their world. I hope that book is getting assigned in a lot of classrooms. And that's why we wanted to talk to David about a clear-eyed view of what actually helps workers. Because when we talked to small business owners, when we talked to workers, when we talked to people who were told stay home, stay out of work, mm-hmm. one of the comments that I remember back in early April was a small business owner who happens to be of British descent but lives in Rochester, been here for 20 years, and he said, this is basic. He said, when the government tells you that you didn't make a mistake, but you can't go to work, you've got to stay home, it's not your fault, this is a circumstance out of your control, but you cannot work, but you still have to keep paying your mortgage or your rent, that's not fair. So if the government's saying don't work, the government should say rent is suspended, mortgages are suspended, even credit card payments are suspended. And he thought that was what he called it, Econ 101, and he was baffled by all the politicians, in his words, standing in front of the cameras, doing photo ops, patting themselves on the back, and not actually helping workers. Do you agree with that assessment? Could we have seen a scenario in which we had mortgage and rent suspension and even credit card suspension, payment suspension?
Yeah, I mean, early on, what was happening was that economic time had stopped. We were all told to go back into our homes. The economy, for all intents and purposes, had ceased, but financial time didn't stop. Financial time being the bills that you have to pay, the rent and the credit cards and things like that. And it did make a certain amount of sense to do one of two things. One would be to stop financial time in the same way that you stopped economic time. The second option, which was taken in a number of countries, was to use the government to supplement payrolls, to essentially keep everybody on economic time. To, you know, and this was done in the UK, this was done in Denmark and places all over the world where their unemployment rate did not go up by any significant amount or at all, really, because the government supplemented that payroll. What we did was we essentially induced people to go onto unemployment. We expanded that unemployment, which was good in the short term, particularly for workers in the low wage sector, which were actually making more money on unemployment than they were that would have in their jobs, but that was time limited. And when it ended in the end of July, people got back into the position of getting too little relief on unemployment. That unemployment is rapidly running out. We're now past the 6-month mark, which is pretty typical for states to extend unemployment. There's about 2 million people, 2.5 million people over 27 weeks of unemployment. There's an extension in the law for another 13 weeks, but that ends at the end of December. That program ends completely. It's one of the programs that was in the CARES Act. And so does pandemic unemployment assistance, which is the unemployment for workers who normally aren't covered by unemployment, like gig workers and freelancers and things like that. So those programs are over at the end of December, meaning that not only will they not be eligible for state-based unemployment, and there won't be any federal either, so it's not that they will get a too inadequate amount of unemployment insurance payments. They will get none. They will get $0. And that's the real fear of not reaching a deal prior to that point. So this, you know, it's certainly we could have handled this in a different way. And my feeling is that if we were going to pick whether it was moving people to unemployment or supplementing their payrolls, what had to be done is that it had to be extended for the duration of the national emergency. Now, if you think about what Trump was saying in March and April, that this would go away with the heat, it might not have been a big lift to just put in a rider that said these things will continue for the duration of the national emergency. It would have created incentives within the government to actually end the national emergency, which we don't see in evidence throughout our elevated case counts and deaths in the summer and a continued wave that's happening right now. So that was the huge mistake here, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that, because I've seen you make that point that there could have been this rider that says the relief will continue throughout the duration of the national emergency. And I thought, well, I mean, I don't think the GOP would have signed off on that. But you are making the point that there was a lot of rhetoric at the time that this thing was going to be over soon. So maybe they would have done that. Well, so let's attack a couple of other points here. There was talk at the time that the $1,200 on the sliding scale, the one-time relief check for Americans, could become semi-permanent, permanent throughout the duration of the pandemic, every other month, et cetera. Even Joe Morelli, who is a member of Congress now here in Rochester, he's from Rochester, he fills the seat that was long held by the late Louise Slaughter. He said on this program in the summer that he had never really thought honestly about UBI, but given the complexity of dealing with this pandemic, he liked the elegance of it, the simplicity of just giving people money instead of saying, okay, we're going to cancel rent and mortgages, but should we backstop the banks, which I'm sure you might have something to say about that. But essentially, he was saying that just putting money in the hands of people and letting them decide, here are the bills I've got to prioritize and here's how I stay afloat, as opposed to trying to do if X, then Y, might make more sense. Now, we haven't seen it. We haven't seen a UBI. We haven't even seen a second relief check. We could, given the political nature of the next month. But I'm wondering if you do think UBI should have had its moment, or should have had its moment at least during the pandemic.
I mean, I guess I would argue that it did have its moment. So you could view the $600 a week boost to unemployment as a kind of UBI. And it was, you know, that's roughly $2,400 a month, which is two times the one-time stimulus check every month. Now, we only did it for four, but what we saw come out of that economically was dramatic. During those months of the pandemic, we saw total compensation, including, compensation from the government, go up in the country, which is incredible considering how the level of unemployment that we saw. We saw disposable income increase. We saw savings go up pretty massively. And we saw poverty go down. I mean, there were a number of positive effects of having this $600 a week go forward. Now, I would say that this was certainly necessary given the stoppage of economic time. The question is, what do you do under normal economic circumstances? How do you incorporate a UBI? This obviously was not universal. It was for those who were unemployed. It was partial. You know, there was an imbalance between essential, so-called essential workers who were going to work and bringing home less money than people who were on unemployment from so-called non-essential jobs. So, you know, there was a lot to work out there in terms of making this equitable, in terms of making it universally accessible. But it's clear to me that the concept of just giving people money did have a very positive impact with respect to this crisis. The problem, of course, was that it was temporary.
Do you think that there is a way that it gets revived? I mean, there's this school of thought that if it's not going to happen in April, May, June, in the middle of a pandemic, it ain't ever going to happen in this country.
Right. I mean, the one thing I would say is that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the election, but what we do have now is a public record of what something that is effectively a UBI, how it impacts an economy and how it assists people at the bottom of the economic ladder. So, you know, it's not theoretical anymore. It's not Andrew Yang saying it, right? It's we actually did this, and we did it for $2,400 a month, and this is what happened. And here are the positive knock-on effects economically. So that's a different, you know, we just didn't have that data before. And, you know, to the extent that data matters, which is an open question in Washington, that's an argument that supporters of a cash transfer kind of philosophy can bring to bear on the political system.
Well, I know a question that you get often and a question that the country has tried to grapple with is, how in the world has the Dow held the numbers it's held? And can we now separate this notion once and for all that it's a reflection of how people are doing?
Right. So, I mean, the least offensive case for why the Dow is so high and the public still sees this massive suffering is that the Dow is the stock market is an indicator of future expectations of profits. And large sections of the Dow are now dominated by giant tech firms, and those giant tech firms have a positive case to make about their expected future profits because they've all gained market share in the pandemic. So in that sense, the stock market and the economy are somewhat linked. But what that neglects is that at least half, and actually probably much more, of the economy is not in the public markets. So when you're talking about small businesses, which employ 47% of the workforce, they are not reflected at all within our public markets. And we're seeing small businesses get absolutely crushed, whether you're talking about the restaurant sector, the local retail sector, things like that. That has only increased the market share for chain restaurants, for big box stores, and things like that, who are in the public market. So you can say that it's an indicator of those companies, but those companies are only gaining because the rest of the economy, not reflected in the stock market, is losing. And so I think what we see with the rise of the Dow is an expression of this extreme inequality of wealth and income, but also inequality between markets, the concentration of the economy throughout sectors in the hands of a few companies that happen to be publicly traded.
I thought there was a moment. I'm so naive, David. There was a moment in March when the Dow looked like it was going to fully collapse and was in the process of doing so. And there was this, I don't remember if this is when the CARES Act came through, but there was announcements and the president ends up signing for Lou Dobbs, the one-day market turnaround, the market jump in March, as if it was a mission accomplished moment. And you talk about gauche and out of touch. I mean, how many people don't even benefit from that at all, as if that mattered. Somehow that wasn't politically disqualifying, but we're also in an alternate universe in which I can no longer predict anything. But does it indicate to you, is that further evidence for the case that you're making that if you want to just bifurcate the parties in terms of their interests, the GOP does view it as a sort of mission accomplished if the Dow is doing pretty well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true of the political class more generally. And it's a problem. There was no pressure really on anybody in Washington to really get something done further than the CARES Act because the Dow was holding up. And the one moment where everybody's hair was on fire was when the Dow was down. And to the extent that Trump reversed his announcement that he would no longer hold stimulus talks until after the election, that was because stocks fell for one day. It took one day of stocks falling for him to reverse that opinion. So certainly, I think what we see is that political class is invested. They have who they talk to, who their donors are, their contributors are, the mind share of those people all points to in that same direction toward people who, are they conflate the economy and the stock market. So this is sort of a larger problem about the insulation of Washington and the way that they look at the economy.
I am curious to know if you think that artificial props aside, inevitably, Wall Street, the Dow, the markets will see some level of collapse, especially this winter, if a lot of the sort of the checks come due and businesses can't hang in there.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a tough ride. I mean, we're starting to see now that the economic situation has shifted. The economic situation was largely pandemic induced, had businesses in any sector that required large indoor gathering essentially shut down. The leisure sector, the travel sector, hospitality sector, those were the ones that were really in trouble. But you started to see a shift, and it started with those sectors, but it was as much induced by a depressed economy as it was the pandemic itself. So Disney cut 28,000 jobs, and AT&T said they were going to cut 20% of their workforce. And the airlines have decided on October 1st, when they could, under the terms of their bailout, cut 30,000 jobs. And those mass layoffs are indicative usually of a business saying, well, we're not going to recover and we need to retrench. And we it's of a different character. It's saying that demand isn't going to come back. Not that we need to just sort of get ourselves on a bridge to when this pandemic is over and then we can, you know, open the floodgates again. They're saying, no, actually demand is permanently lower and we need our business to reflect that. So that is indicative of a deeper problem. And I think that to the extent that there's a new administration in Washington in January, that's going to be the biggest problem that they're going to be facing.
After our only break, David Dayen discusses what Congress can do next, with more businesses closing every week. And there are very few writers in the country who have spent more time analyzing the foreclosure crisis, how so many Americans lost their homes. One of the players in that crisis was Steven Mnuchin. We'll discuss that and more coming up. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with local faith leaders who have issued an open letter offering support for the demands issued by Free the People Rock. Free the People created this list of demands following the death of Daniel Prude. They want significant changes to how policing is done, to how mental health services are offered, and to who the leadership of the city of Rochester is and is not. We'll talk to faith leaders next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking to David Dayen, the executive editor of The American Prospect. On the subject of what Nancy Pelosi said to Jake Tapper, the point that you make about Pelosi essentially saying, hey, calm down, we're gonna figure this out. We're gonna continue to work on helping the American people. Congress will negotiate more help. We can do that. You know, you could argue that she's just really bad at politics or was being, you know, sort of naive, mm-hmm. naive to a fault there. I think you've used the word, used the phrase lack of urgency and arrogance about getting more chances to get this done. And I don't want to ask you to sort of analyze her mind on this, but I do want to ask if you think the Democrats generally as a party actually understand what American workers need and are willing to go to the mat for it. Because if the point that you make about the Republicans getting what they wanted and needed in March is fair, and what we've seen is the top earners, the top 10% of income earners essentially restored fully, and almost all of the pain happening at the low to middle end of the income scale in this country for the last 7 months. If that is true, then do you believe the Democrats actually understand workers anymore and care enough?
I mean, it's a good question. I think that they, you know, I guess to sort of take their best version of the argument is that they did care, and in March they created this situation and a framework where those people would be protected, and they were protected. The problem was that it didn't continue, and they made a real mistake in not extending that relief. I, you know, it's hard for me to really come down on one side or the other of the was this incompetence or was this arrogance or you know what were the factors that led to this. So I don't want to punt the question completely, but I tend to not try to mind read and just look at the results. And it's clear for me that if you look at those results, that Democrats did not follow the course that they purported to want to follow, which is to protect people for throughout this terrible crisis.
What would you have them do right now then to change that course?
Well, I think it's hard now. I mean, that's one thing. I mean, I've heard that from folks. What do you do now? It's too much informed by the past. What I would say is that there's a really interesting dynamic going on right now where Pelosi and Mnuchin are having these talks. Pelosi is resisting what has become a pretty good offer on the part of the Trump administration. It's up to $1.8 trillion. It includes $300 billion for state and local governments. It includes $400 a week, which is not $600 a week, but it's a significant amount in people's paychecks as an extra in employment enhancement. It includes another $1,200 set of checks that is actually bigger for dependent children, which mimics sort of the increase in the child tax credit that Democrats want. It's a significant offer, and Pelosi is resisting it, you know, saying it's inadequate. I don't know if she's doing that to just sort of hold off to exert sort of maximum pressure on Senate Republicans, or if she is so dug in on her Heroes Act bill that she can't see giving up, you know, another inch. But it certainly would be politically useful. I question whether anything is going to take Mitch McConnell to the point of putting on the floor an expansive bill that's over $1 trillion. But it certainly would have political value to get Republican, vulnerable Republican senators to have to make that choice between ramming through a Supreme Court justice or giving relief to the American people.
Well, you've actually had some interesting things to say about Judge Barrett in regards to workers. I want to get to that in just a moment. But just briefly on that subject, I mean, you really believe that Mitch McConnell is looking past this election already, even looking to 2022. I'd like to get your thoughts on that, David. And I also wonder, as much as Nancy Pelosi might feel that it's important to get every inch of the Heroes Act, is it also possible that she feels this is way too close to an election to negotiate a deal with his White House and give him any victory at all?
I think that is probably part of Pelosi's thinking. I don't think that's terribly realistic. The money will not get out in time to have a meaningful impact. What are we at? 10 million people have already voted, so obviously it wouldn't affect their vote in any way. I think that Trump's problems go way beyond the economy right now. They're rooted in the public health crisis that he is blamed for allowing to fester. And I don't think this would help him in a very meaningful way. So that's number one. I do believe that McConnell has kind of the same view that I just expressed, that 2020 is over, that it's too late for Trump to come back. It's too late to do anything more than triage in terms of the Senate. Maybe you get, maybe Republicans limit their losses to keeping 47, 48, 49 seats, but they're not going to retain the Senate. And I think McConnell knows this. And I think what he's thinking is, okay, knowing that we're going to have a Democratic trifecta in 2021, what's my best course of action? Is it to inject $1.8 trillion into the economy so a President Biden can get off to a good start? Or is it to do what I did in 2009, fighting Democrats tooth and nail, slowing down the recovery and setting the stage for a big comeback in the midterms? And I feel like he's engaging in that latter strategy. He really does not want to put an incoming president on the Democratic side in a good position economically. He wants him to, you know, it's a really selfish and really deplorable kind of strategy, but it fits with everything we know about Mitch McConnell.
Do you have any sympathy or empathy for the small business owners who Mitch McConnell and others have cited as saying that the $600 has led to some workers deciding that they will choose not to go back to work?
No. And the reason I don't have any sympathy for that is that we've seen a large number of those temporary job losses, those furloughs, have people return to work. And the $600 had nothing to do with it. Even in June and July, which were and May, which were the largest months for job recovery that we've seen, they've only started to fade since the $600 has phased out, in fact. It just doesn't seem like, if you look at the evidence, that that was a factor. And, you know, and even if it was a factor, there are ways to use other strategies to ensure people aren't hurt by the fact that their industry disintegrated, essentially. You know, one of them being supporting payroll up to 100%. Another being, minimizing the $600 concurrent with the unemployment rate. There are plenty of strategies that you could undertake, but I really sharply question the idea that there was this disincentive to work because millions of people went back to work.
Well, one of the people, of course, who's been at the center of these negotiations and announcements about relief is Steve Mnuchin. And looking back at the Trump administration's choices of who they've installed in these various positions, you, of course, have written quite a bit about Steve Mnuchin. How much do you think the average American knows about someone like Steve Mnuchin and the work he's done before joining the Trump administration?
Mnuchin is just such an interesting figure. And yeah, I did co-author a book about him. and his activities, many of which that book went into predated his treasury days. I do think it's important at some level. I think Mnuchin is trying to sort of thread a needle where he is certainly desirous of getting his guys, his affiliate group, which is large businesses, finance, make them whole during the pandemic. He's certainly done that. He has less sympathy for state and local governments, for smaller businesses. If you look at the ways in which Mnuchin, through Treasury and the Federal Reserve, have collaborated on the various credit facilities, they've been much more generous to large businesses than small ones. They've been more generous to, for example, the oil industry than they have been to state and local governments, which have received exactly two loans from the municipal credit facility that has been created to help them through with bridge funding. So, how does this relate to Mnuchin's prior work and philosophy? I mean, he's marinated in that world. He was a Goldman Sachs legacy. He came up through that bank. He ended up buying his own bank, One West. He was deeply involved in the foreclosure crisis and some of the abuses that took place there. He was in Hollywood as a producer. He's been part of the financial world for his entire working career. So, where do his sympathies lie? Where does his mindset and thinking about the world originate? I think it's pretty clear to see.
Can you just give one brief example for listeners who don't know the stories about, for listeners who might say, well, if you're going to get foreclosed on, you've made mistakes, you haven't made payments, you haven't kept current. What's an example that stands out to you that says you don't understand the full story?
Do you mean in terms of
I think the
saying that, or?
The predatory way that people lost their homes over, the slightest
Sure.
errors.
Yeah, I mean, there's one story through One West that they foreclosed on someone who was short on their payment by 27 cents. There are other stories of them changing the locks on people who never missed a payment. There are stories of them using what was known as RoboSign to look at this documentation that is going to change the financial life of somebody, and saying that they'll spend 30 seconds looking at that documentation. So certainly, the philosophy of One West Bank, and by extension, I guess, Mnuchin, is that there's this tremendous amount of personal responsibility on the part of borrowers, on the part of homeowners, to dot every I and cross every T. But certainly what we've seen in this crisis is that level of responsibility wasn't required of the larger businesses who were simply bailed out.
Yeah, I think your writing demonstrates Mnuchin is the opposite of what Trump claimed that he was going to bring to Washington. And Trump himself as a person is sort of the opposite of what a lot of people talk about him like he's sort of an alpha male and a guy who's definitely never fixed a tire. Or built anything with his own hands. I mean, I'm not trying to be unkind, but I guess when I saw the Steve Mnuchins of the world going to Washington to work for this administration, I thought, well, clearly the president's 60 million voters are going to see this and say, we got sold out. But I think that after 4 years, it's clear to me this is just about identity politics, a very, very entrenched case of identity politics. How do you see it?
Yeah, and it's identity politics at a level that's not really talked about in that context. But yeah, certainly. I mean, a lot of ink has been spilled about how Donald Trump came in with this new notion of populism, of transforming the Republican Party on issues like trade and things like that. But he's really governed as sort of a bog standard Republican, maybe a little more kleptocratic than the normal one, but someone deeply interested in tax cuts and deregulation, and that has been the main agenda for the last 4 years. And certainly, The concept of draining the swamp has not really extended through to beyond the campaign rhetoric.
Let me squeeze in a couple more quick ones for David Dayen, the executive editor of the American Prospect, because as we talk about Mnuchin, David in his work has not spared Democrats and anyone installed under different administrations, too. You've been writing a little bit about Tim Geithner, his private equity firm that owns two of the most, as you say, exploitative companies in the U.S. economy. And ProPublica wrote about the customer service reps for Disney and Airbnb who have to pay to talk to you. They wrote about corporations shedding costs at the expense of workers, and especially so during this pandemic. It's essentially opened up a 7-month window for even more exploitation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, as you said, it was ProPublica's story, but there's this company called Arise, and Arise is sort of a work-at-home customer service contractor. So the individuals who work with Arise are seen as independent contractors. They have to pay for their own training to be customer service representatives, and then they're essentially loaned out to large businesses like Disney and Airbnb and these other companies, and they do their customer service calls from home, and shouldering all the burden of training and these other expenses, such that they end up making, you know, even less than the minimum wage, in the response. So it's purely a way for these large businesses to, as I mentioned, shed costs. You know, this aligns, and this company, Arise, is part of the private equity portfolio of Geithner, who runs a private equity firm called Warburg Pincus. He was made president of that after he left Treasury. So there's another Geithner, or another Warburg Pincus portfolio company called Mariner Finance, which sends out checks to poor people, and the fine print of the check says that this is actually not just a gift, but a high-cost loan. And if you cash the check, you are agreeing to this loan policy, and you're going to be put into debt. So these are the kinds of companies that Tim Geithner has in this portfolio at Warburg Pincus. And it's indicative of the fact that maybe the most predatory Treasury Secretary of our lifetime is not residing in the Treasury building right now.
Do you agree with Matt Stoller, who has written that Democrats are way too, in his words, drunk on Obama, the idea that if we can just get back there, things will be fine, as opposed to asking the hard questions about what did and did not happen in those 8 years?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, you can debate endlessly over the factors that led to Trump's rise, but I think a country that was more equitable, and where prosperity was more broadly shared, could not have had someone like a Trump get traction. So you know, it's the question of how much of the problems that we face were left to fester and not be dealt with. Certainly, when you're talking about regional inequality, which very directly led to Trump's rise because of states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan that were left behind. And you look at Obama administration policies, which led to a lot of winner-take-all corporations and the sort of sucking out of wealth and power to these little fiefdoms on the coast. You know, those things have a direct correlation. So, you know, I think that the future has to be considering how to make the prosperity that exists within our country more equitable, more broadly shared, and more regionally spread.
Well, I mean, your new book is Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Do you see a window in which a Biden administration would actually wield a sort of Brandeisian streak to kind of try to decentralize corporate power? Could that actually happen?
Well, I think that it's going to have to come from a movement of the people. I think there are people in Washington that are certainly interested in it. Last week, we saw the House Antitrust Subcommittee come out with this report on the large tech firms, which was really just sort of a case study of concentration within our economy more generally, and laid out a really great blueprint for how to revive antitrust for the 21st century. So the ideas are on the shelf. It's a matter of getting a movement together that forces the political system to take that blueprint and run with it. So, and you know, in my book, I talk to people who you know have certainly are available to be part of that movement. They have seen this in their daily lives. They have seen how it affected them. And they feel like there's something wrong in the economy that's rigged on behalf of corporate interests, and that something needs to change. And so it's about galvanizing that undercurrent within our country and our society, and making sure that's being put to ends to pressure a Biden administration and the group of leaders in Washington that they have to do something about this.
Let me wrap with this, David. You've written a little bit this week about Judge Barrett's record, and you write that her record indicates siding with businesses over workers. You write a number of her decisions deprive employees and other vulnerable populations of their civil rights, and you say, quote, "Everyone knows she's been installed to deliver victories on long-sought ideologically conservative priorities, from eliminating the right to choose an abortion to the overturning of a century of labor law jurisprudence. And everyone knows conservative senators will vote in lockstep to get Barrett on the court to commence this work. The only drama lies in whether enough of them are actually available to complete the task before the general election," end quote. Now, the discussion of Judge Barrett has often focused on Roe, but you say there's also an indication in her record of a willingness to overturn a century of labor law jurisprudence. How do you see that?
Yeah, there are a bunch of cases where she has clearly lined up with a business, even if that business is effectively depriving workers or customers of their civil rights. There's a case called EEOC versus AutoZone, where AutoZone in the south side of Chicago was creating stores that were staffed by African Americans and stores that were solely staffed by Hispanics, like creating a black store and a Hispanic store, segregating their employees in this manner. And Barrett declined to rehear a case about this, and essentially sided with this notion that as long as the separate but equal facilities are really equal, that they can be separate, which flies in the face of things like Brown versus the Board of Education. And there are other rulings as well, one around workplace discrimination and hostile work environments, one around age discrimination. She joined a decision where a job application was posted that had a maximum number of years of experience. She sort of rewrote the law under the relevant statute, saying it applied not to job applicants, only to current employees, which allows for what amounts to age discrimination in hiring. There are just a host of these rulings, and she hasn't been on the bench very long, only about 3 years. But in this scant record, you can see this willingness to really go along with whatever businesses and employers want to do, even if the stakes leave out civil rights protections for their workers.
David Dayen is the executive editor of The American Prospect, the author of Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power, and Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Some really important work, and we are grateful for the time. You're generous with it. Thank you very much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
You can find more of his work at prospect.org. And just a a note to listeners on this. A number of listeners have asked and reached out asking if we could book an interview with David Dayan. It's our first with David. We enjoyed the conversation, and I've been reading his work for years now. If you have thoughts about who you'd like to see on the program, you can always reach out. We want to hear from you. What are you hearing on the program that you want to hear more of? What are you not hearing that you want to hear? Are there specific guests, writers, authors, thinkers, or people in this community? You can email the program anytime you want. We'd love to hear from you. It's connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. The engineer of Connections is Rob Braden. The producer of Connections is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, wherever you are. And we will talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.